And with our special guest tonight, Templar Knight, Mark Pinkham. We'll be back with Mark in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Mark Pinkham, our guest. Mark, let's talk about alchemy for a moment, because you have studied it. Again, the original purpose for alchemy was what? What did they want to do?
The original purpose for alchemy, George, is simply to create this energy of the Holy Grail, this energy that initiates a process of transformation within the human body. This is how it all began. To do that, there was originally there were many practices that you could do, but ultimately, what they would do, these practices would do, would unite the male and the female energies together. The polarity comes together, and I've actually practiced and studied many of these techniques in India. We know that the Templars were involved with some of these practices that they learned through the Sufis, who had in turn learn them from India, but also a lot came up from Kemet, which is the ancient name for Egypt. And that's basically what it's all about, is uniting the polarity together. For example, there's places in the body that are associated with fire. There's places in the body associated with water, so you want to unite the water and the fire. There's in both sexes, there are both male and female hormones. You try to unite those together. Of course, another way is simply uniting the sexes together. That's sexual tantra, uniting the polarity that way. You can also make the physical pill of immortality, or the philosopher's stone, if you will, which is what the alchemists of Europe were trying to do by uniting substances that were associated with the male-female with those associated with the female principle, and calling them philosophical mercury and philosophical sulfur. And by uniting them together in just the right way, it would create a red stone, a very fiery red stone, which kind of simulated the energy of the kundalini power that exists within the human body that does the work of transformation when it's activated.
When I was in school, Mark, they used to tell us that the alchemists wanted to make gold.
That's right, yeah. But that's kind of a lower degenerated version of alchemy. Originally, the alchemy was uniting the polarity within the body and awakening that energy of kundalini. Later on, it became to create the philosopher's stone, so that essentially you're creating that energy outside the physical body, and then you would kind of crumble that philosopher's stone up, that red stone, and then you would spread it, dust a metal like lead, and then it would transform into a gold. But originally, if you study alchemy, they say that the true alchemy is creating that energy, that alchemical energy within the human body.
Coast to Coast guest Lawrence Gardner says that part of the effort of the alchemist was to create a white powder of gold, which would allow them to do incredible things. Have you ever heard of that?
Oh, yes. I've studied all kinds of different forms of alchemy, and certainly that is one of them. And apparently they found that white powder in certain of the temples in Egypt, Mount Sinai, different places such as that. It's a valid approach, and I've actually used the white powder gold myself. However, I haven't gotten very dramatic results from it, and I wouldn't necessarily prescribe it for other people, because there as far as I know, there aren't any real masters on the planet today who have actually gone the whole route of alchemy by taking that white powder gold. So it's actually a little bit dangerous at this point.
Okay, now earlier you were telling me about the martial arts that were important for this. Tell me about that.
Okay, well, the martial arts, one thing is going to break down a person's fear so that they can be a true warrior, a true Gnostic warrior, and live without fear. To develop true Gnosticism, you have to go beyond the fear. That's one thing that keeps us from being in that Gnostic state. It's the fear that keeps our mind generating all these thoughts, and all these thoughts that keep our mind from being totally free. You need a clear mind, what they call in Zen the no mind, before that Gnostic consciousness can really take root. But another reason for these martial arts is so that everybody can learn to move in harmony with the life force. Most of the martial arts started with Tai Chi, which was created by masters in the Far East who knew how to move their body totally in harmony with the life force. And the life force moves in kind of a circular, spiral way. And most of these moves in Tai Chi, you'll find, move in a circular way. Now, if you practice Tai Chi every day, not only will you learn how to move in harmony with the life force physically, but you'll find that everything else in your life becomes more balanced as well. Your job, your relationships, everything. And so thus, by studying these martial arts, you're able to master not only the physical body, but also many other aspects, other areas of your life.
Do most religions recommend that? I don't think so. I've never heard of that before.
Well, I think that religion is, when I think of religion, I think of kind of entry level, where people are just kind of getting their feet wet on spirituality, mm-hmm. and when they're ready to move on, they move on to these other practices. And I think that when they are ready, they move on to practices such as yoga, such as meditation, such as Tai Chi, where they are working physically to purify their bodies. So I think that you'll find that if you go deeper into spirituality and you study these paths that people embark on when they're really seriously ready to totally commit their lives to a spiritual path.
Does your Gnostic teachings say or react at all to life beyond this planet, extraterrestrial visitation, anything like that, Mark?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Just like the Freemasons in their lodges, they defer to the blazing star over their altars, which represents the star Sirius. So do we, because of course we became the Freemasons, and in our tradition we believe that a lot of our rites actually came through missionaries from the star Sirius. A lot of the alchemical rites. We believe that the Templars were initiated into the Holy Grail lineage that started in the Far East, and that actually started with the Sons of God, which the Theosophists in the Far East have found came from Venus. So absolutely, and actually I myself and others in the tradition have felt a special relationship to Sirius and Venus. And it appears as though a lot of the alchemical traditions on the planet today came from those two points, those two stars. And in Theosophy, at one point, people like Alice Bailey were doing a lot of channeling from extraterrestrials, and they found out, for example, that the Sirians, or Sirius is known as the Great White Lodge, and the Sirians actually did bring the first three levels of Freemasonry to this planet. Of entered apprentice, fellow craft, and master mason. And so, you know, we can't say conclusively that this is true, but it's something that we're looking into and exploring.
You've heard of the Dogon tribe?
And their connection to Sirius. So, and because of the Dogon and tribes such as that, we're more convinced that, yes, the Sirians did indeed traveled to this planet as missionaries at some time in the past, and also there's the story of the Chintamani stone and Nicholas Roark, how the Chintamani stone came from Sirius, was brought here by missionaries, and it was in the possession of the League of Nations originally, and then after the League of Nations collapsed, it was taken back to the Far East and in Shambhala by Nicholas Roark. So there's a lot of those references to Sirius and Venus in the esoteric literature.
Well, Mark, you know, that fascinates me a lot, because there are different types of practices that have talked about visitations in the past. And one has to assume after a while, if you hear it from five or six different kinds of organizations, groups, what have you, something happened here thousands of years ago. You got to believe that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm also trained as a shaman in a Peruvian tradition that uses a kind of a cactus called the San Pedro Huachuma. And for thousands of years, the shamans down there have been seeing into other realms and other dimensions and having interdimensional experience. And they actually say that cactus came from Venus originally. And when you're under the influence, that you can often have visitations or experiences of Venusians. And the teacher that I studied with had a number of them. He was even taken aboard a Venusian craft at one point. But one of the main things I find on any kind of San Pedro experience is that people, if they do it at night, they look up at the star Venus, and there's always some kind of special gift or some kind of special energy or light that emanates from that star and comes right to them. So it does definitely seem to be some special connection there.
What was the name of that cactus again?
Well, it's San Pedro, of course, is St. Peter, or Huachuma. Huachuma is a more ancient Inca name for it. Of course, San Pedro is the Spanish name. When the Spanish conquistador showed up, that's what they named it.
If you do a Google search for San Pedro cactus, would it come up like that?
Yes, it probably would, yeah, absolutely.
And what do you do, eat it or drink it?
Well, it's actually made into a liquid, a drink, and you drink it. It gives you visions. It's the old shamanic path all over the world. The shamans were involved with taking some kind of sacrament like that.
And it won't hurt you?
No, not at all. But you have to take it under the guidance of a shaman.
Like ayahuasca, right?
It's somewhat similar. I think ayahuasca is definitely a lot more intense, and you're a lot more liable to vomit or have a negative physical reaction than you are with Huachuma.
Now, why do you need a shaman there with you?
Just because he knows exact dose, and if there is any kind of negative reactions you have, the shaman knows what to do about it,
That's a good point, how to take you out of it.
Exactly, right.
Some of the things that you read about in the curriculum of the order, the Arthurian tarot, is that for the tarot cards?
Yeah, absolutely. Tarot has within it many of the mysteries of the universe, and the tarot we really believe comes out of the Holy Grail tradition. You find in the minor arcana the different suits. The four suits are correspond to the four different manifestations of the Holy Grail, with the sword and the spear and the stone or the rock and the chalice. And we believe that if you do a study of the major and minor arcana, you can get an understanding of the true Holy Grail lineage and the whole path of alchemical transformation.
Do you also believe in the Bible has the Book of Revelation, end times?
Oh, absolutely.
You do?
Okay. I believe in that. But of course, there's many different interpretations you can come up with by studying that.
Sure.
And I don't know that there's just one. And I think that it kind of speaks to everybody differently, you know. But St. John the Apostle is a very important figure in our tradition. He's a patron of our tradition. He's a grandmaster of this Holy Grail lineage that the Templars were initiated into in the Holy Land. And he's really one of the original fathers of Gnosticism in the West. And so it was the revelation of St. John, as well as the Gospel of St. John, which were the principal scriptures of most all of the Gnostic sects in ancient times. And they're some of our principal texts as well.
Of everything you've studied, Mark, everything that's out there, is there one aspect that has fascinated you more than anything?
Yeah, I would say probably the Kundalini. Just to see the manifestations of Kundalini, to feel that energy. When you sit down to meditate and you repeat a few mantras and you feel it's kind of emerged out of the base of your spine, and the next thing you know, you're flying, you're astral traveling through the universe, or you're on some astral planet, or you're having this intense vision, or you're bouncing up and down like a rubber ball. It's just, it's really rather phenomenal to see this and to experience it. So I think of everything I've undergone, I would have to say that that ranks up at the top of the list.
Well, I got to tell you, this is fascinating talking with you about this, Mark, because it echoes so many things that a lot of people have studied. How close is this to the Rosicrucians and what they believe in?
Well, it's very close, because the Rosicrucians, they were all alchemists. And if you study the legend of Christian Rosicrucius, even though that's kind of a metaphor for the origination of the order, it talks about Christian Rosicrucius going and studying alchemy in Damkar, Damascus, and in Fez among the Sufis. So they were very much involved with creating the alchemical substance, the alchemical power of transformation. And they were actually known as fire philosophers because of that, because they were interested in creating that fire, that inner fire. And you know, the symbol of the Rosicrucians is a cross with a rose on it. Well, the rose in ancient times was the symbol of Venus, and Venus was known as the star of alchemy, or the patroness of all alchemy. So it aligns them with this very ancient Venusian tradition that we ourselves are aligned with. And so there's a very close connection, actually, with the Rosicrucians and the Templars. And in fact, the Templars at one point were known as the Knights of the Rose Cross.
Tell me about Merlin. You ever stumble across him in any of your works and readings?
Absolutely, yeah. It appears as though there was definitely more than one Merlin, I think. And it appears as though it could have been an office of magicians that were actually served some of the ancient Irish and Scottish kings, because there's actually many names for them, and supposedly they did many different things. Certainly, I think that they were very incredible masters. Of course, the legend of Merlin is that he was fathered by the Dragon of Destruction, which means that he had the power. He had this Kundalini power. He had the command of it, and it's this Kundalini power through which that one can create universes. It can do great magic, and this is why in ancient times it was always important to go through a long process of apprenticeship with a master, Kundalini master, before that energy was awakened within you. Because if it was awakened and you're not ready, then you would use that power for your own purposes, and it could bring the destruction to you and much of the planet, for that matter.
Was Merlin a good guy? One of the good people?
It appears as though, from his legend, yes, he definitely was. He used that power in a very positive, uplifting, beneficial way. I think that he did have a human side in the stories, and he had to suffer for that. But I would say, in general, that definitely he was one of the good guys. I would probably say that he was probably descended from the Tuatha De Danann people, ultimately, who were great masters. They were the first masters, first alchemical masters and Kundalini masters up there in Great Britain, and they were the people of Dana Danu, which is the name of the goddess. And these Danus or Danans once covered much of the planet. And you've got the Danavas in India, the tribe of Dan, and they were all associated with the serpent and with magic, and they had great magical powers.
Okay, well, you stay with us, Mark, when we come back. I'll tell you what, we'll open up our fast blasts. I'll take some questions from you there, and then next hour, phone calls with our guest, Mark Pinkham, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you've registered to Fast Blast Me, we'll go ahead and start sending some questions. I'll relay them to Mark Pinkham. If you haven't, just go to the left side of the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at that. You will see some eyes there. No, they're not mine. They're Sigmund Freud's, and that's where you register for Fast Blast. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Mark, have the Knights Templars of today have direct knowledge of the ancient Templars and some of their specifics, or have we lost that in the years and years and years?
I would definitely say we've lost it, and this is one reason that we formed the IOGT is to revive that ancient wisdom. What happened was early 1800s. There was a man named Bernard Fabre Palipart who was involved with reviving the Templar tradition in France, and he especially revived the Gnostic rites and the Gnostic ideology, and this continued until mid 1800s when there was a split within the order, so that the kind of the Gnostic rites and Gnostic practices went their own way and became the Johannite Church today, and then the Templar order at that point simply became more of a military order, more of a charitable organization, and today it's usually known as the SMOTJ, the Sovereign Military Order of the Temple of Jerusalem, and its membership is mostly active or retired military. You also have, though, in the York Rite, a Freemasonry. The last degree is the degree of the Knights Templar, and they actually perform some of the ancient rites that the Templars themselves once did, such as originally, they drank out of a skull, and the Templars used a lot of skull as part of their Gnostic rites. But I don't think you're going to find that a lot of people in the York Rite really understand what this is all about. And so, even though they might be practicing some of the ancient rites, they've really lost the interpretation or the understanding of them. And this is what we're trying to bring back.
Dana from Chico, California wants to know if you ever did any research into Fulcanelli and his book, The Mysteries of the Cathedrals.
I have come across that book at times, and how it refers to the goddess tradition and the activation of that energy, that Holy Spirit energy, using sacred principles and sacred geometry in the construction of these cathedrals. And we know that the Templars actually trained many of the Masons. And many of the Masons were actually Templars themselves, because there was three levels of Templars. There was the sergeants, the knights, and then the chaplains, and one division of the sergeants were to be Masons, and so Templars themselves were Masons, and they created a lot of these Gothic cathedrals to generate that alchemical power, and a lot of that wisdom they learned from the Sufis. The Gothic arch actually came from the Sufis, and it's known that the Templars studied directly from the Al-Banna, which is a division of Sufis, which is dedicated to building and sacred geometry.
Matthew from Indiana wants to know if you ever saw the movie National Treasure, and if so, if that was an accurate portrayal of some of the things the Knights Templar did.
Yes, I did see that movie. I thought it was well done. However, I don't, from what I've come across, I haven't found that it's completely in alignment with what did happen to the Templar treasure. At this point, it does look as though if it's any place, it's in Roslyn Chapel or maybe one of the Gothic cathedrals in Europe, like Chartres Cathedral, or perhaps it could be in one of the preceptories or the commandaries or the fortresses built by the Templars somewhere in Europe or the Middle East. And at one point, they say there was 800 of those. So they were all over the place. And So I don't think that those treasures necessarily made it over here. I think there's a much better chance that they're still over in Europe or the Middle East.
Sandra from Florida wants to know what you think might be in the Ark of the Covenant.
Might be in the Ark of the Covenant?
Yes.
Well, I don't disagree with historians who say that the probably the tablets, the stone tablets of Moses. I think that there's definitely some secret scriptures, some secret scrolls there, and I think that they do date back to the time of Egypt, and that they were scrolls related to the alchemical traditions of the Osirian priesthood of Egypt. I think that's probably definitely true.
Someone wants to know anonymously, of course, if you could describe how the Roslyn Chapel looks, physically looks.
Well, I think that Well, actually, there's actually a image of it on my website, GnosticTemplars.org. It looks like a small Gothic cathedral, if you know what that looks like. There's 14 flying buttresses, seven on either side of it, which was a special feature of all Gothic architecture. So if you can think of a small version of a Gothic cathedral, basically that's what you've got.
Joshua from Monroe, Michigan wants to know if you've heard of Benjamin Creme or the Maitreya.
I'm familiar with that whole sect or that whole movement. I've seen pictures of this person claiming to be Maitreya. I've seen pictures, films, whatever. I don't really connect with him. I don't have the feeling that he's exactly what he says that he is, and I'm kind of going by my own intuition there, and which more and more I'm trying to depend upon. I think that if he really was the Maitreya, to bring in the New Age as the Templar, the Tibetans predict, that he would have a lot more of a Tibetan following than he seems to.
Sonia from Florida wants to know if you think the Templars might be connected to the ancient Atlanteans.
Well, certainly, and a lot of wisdom and knowledge came from Atlantis. Obviously, there's not a direct link, but it looks as though the missionaries from Atlantis came up through Egypt, as an example, and established the lodges and the sects of alchemists in Egypt. Of course, the Nazis believe that the Atlanteans ended up in somewhere in the Far East, and they came west from there and brought their traditions. I think that also there were some traditions, perhaps, that were brought directly to the Middle East from Atlantis. For example, there are some huge megalithic sites there in the Middle East, which are said to have been built there by the sons of God, who could have been the Atlanteans. Also, there's a tradition of the sons of God landing on Mount Hermon and descending from there and establishing a lineage of giants that were eventually wiped out by the Hebrews under Jeremiah. And also on Hebron, which was the first place where the Jewish kings built their castle, there was a worship of the Kabiri twins. And the Kabiri were known as those of fire, those of the alchemy. And it's believed that the Kabiri twins were originally worshipped on Atlantis. So that could have been a direct Atlantean cult that came to the Middle East, and certainly the Templars could have learned of it when they were there.
Nathan from Oregon wants to know if the San Pedro cactus is prohibited in the United States. Any drug laws, anything like that?
Actually, that's one of the few that isn't, and we'd like to keep it that way. And one way we're going to do that is so that it isn't frivolously used. It's used under the guidance of a shaman. What generally tends to happen is people don't understand these sacraments, and they don't take them under the guidance of someone who does understand them. They take too much, they OD, and then they become illegal. So as long as we can consume these plants that are legal with great respect and under the guidance of shaman, then I think that we're going to be okay. But I'd hate to see that and whatever plants are left over, like salvia divinorum, become illegal simply because we misuse it.
So you obviously don't recommend people grow their own cactus.
I don't unless they're willing to go through some training to understand how to prepare it and the right dosage for them.
Margot from Los Angeles wants to know how you can join the International Order of Gnostic Templars.
Well, I welcome that question. One reason is because we're having an initiation ceremony coming up in December. It'll be the first one in the States. We're going to try to bring our international Grand Prior, Ian Sinclair, over for the event. It's going to be here in Sedona. And How you would apply for it, register for it, you can go onto our Gnostic Templar website and click on initiation to the IOGT. It gives you instructions as to what to do. We're trying to set it up right now so that you, once you get to the initiation page, you can just click on a word or click on something that will actually bring up an application form, and you can directly download it from there. But that is an excellent question, and we welcome all people who are interested in our organization, because we feel that we're right now on the threshold in this world of a new planetary spirituality of uniting East and West, and we want everybody to come together, join with us in that quest, in that goal, in that work. And we feel like we've got the link. We have at least one link, which is the Holy Grail lineage that started in Sri Lanka, came west with the Mandaeans, merged with the Nazarene Essenes, and gave birth to John the Baptist and Jesus and John the Apostle, and then was adopted by the Templars. So we welcome everybody to come together to do this work with us. But it isn't just a planetary work we're doing together. It's also work on ourselves, certainly, and to achieve that level of gnosis. And this is one reason that one of our headquarters is in Sedona, because this is certainly the land of initiation. It has been for thousands of years among the Native Americans. They would come here to get in touch with their gnosis, to come to an understanding of the universe, and also to create lines of communication with their higher self. So they come on vision quests and get answers. And so this is why we were directed to make our headquarters here, is because it promotes the Gnostic experience to everyone who comes here.
Can people keep their own religions and practice that and still be a member of the IOGT?
Oh, absolutely. We would never say that you need to discard your religion. We're just here to enhance whatever you're doing, and perhaps try to take you further on your spiritual path. We would never say discard what you have been practicing, unless you're ready to do that. That's the only way.
Stephanie from Washington, state of, wants to know a little bit more about the John the Baptist connection with the Templars.
Well, that's also a very excellent question. There's a lot to that answer, because, as I mentioned, the Templars were initiated into a Holy Grail lineage that came from Sri Lanka, and you find out the origins of this lineage through the Mandaeans. The Mandaeans are really the only surviving Gnostic sect on the planet today, and they're in southern Iraq. According to their traditions, this lineage started in the Garden of Eden, which today, a third of the world says is Sri Lanka. And then it came west. The Mandaeans came west with their masters. They were great masters of the Mandaean tradition, known as the Nasserai. And with the Nasserai, the Mandaeans merged with the Egyptian culture, then the Persian, and then the Essenes. And then they gave rise to the Essene sect known as the Nasserai, the Nazarenes. And John the Baptist was born into that sect, and he became actually the last prophet of the Mandaeans. And John the Baptist, of course, his focus was baptizing people in the River Jordan, and the focus of Mandaean spirituality is baptism, but with a different consciousness than we baptize today. For one thing, the baptism has to be in flowing water, and a Mandaean priest will actually activate an alchemical energy to flow within that water through certain mantras and certain prayers. So anyway, John the Baptist was the founder of the Gnostic tradition and the Holy Grail lineage in the West, and it's believed that he actually incarnated the energy of the first Grand Master that started the whole lineage in Sri Lanka, who today is worshipped in temples there, and he's known as Murugan or Sanat Kumara or Kartikeya. He's actually the very first Kundalini master that ever lived on this planet. This is how the Hindus know him. And he was full of this Kundalini power. In fact, he was one with it. And so this is why I think they say that John the Baptist incarnated him, or his power, because John the Baptist was full of the Holy Spirit from birth. He was full of that kundalini power, that kundalini energy. And if you go to the Middle East today, the Sufis say, yes, John the Baptist, he was an incarnation of Elijah, the prophet Elijah. Well, they also say that Elijah is another name for Al-Qadir, who's a Sufi green man, and Al-Qadir is another name for this Sanat Kumara, this master from Sri Lanka. So, by a circuitous route, John the Baptist will take you all the way back to this original Holy Grail master called Sanat Kumara Kartikeya.
The fact that the head of John the Baptist, the skull, might be at the Roslyn Chapel, what is the purpose of keeping the skull? You know, what is it supposed to do?
Well, that's a really good question, too. It's believed that the Templars found the head of John the Baptist during the Fourth Crusade when they entered one of the big palaces there. And there was a chapel attached to that palace that had these incredible, valuable relics. It had the Holy Shroud, for example. It had pieces of the original cross, and it also had the head of John the Baptist. Well, it's believed that the Templars took that head back into Europe, and they started using it. They were placing it on their highest altars, and this is the Baphomet, the head of wisdom that they were alleged to have worshipped. When the Templars went before the Inquisition, they actually said that there was incredible power that emanated from that head, and it could actually make trees blossom or grass grow. It had that kind of power associated with it. So it appears as though the head of John the Baptist was still full of that Holy Grail power, that Holy Spirit that John was full of when he was born. And so simply by being in proximity to it, it would have an alchemical effect on you. It was essentially, and I believe, probably the most valuable of all the Holy Grail manifestations that the Templars ever had in their possession. And it's known that they did have the Cup of Christ at one point or another. And one reason that this was the most valuable Holy Grail manifestation is because the Templars knew that they were part of this Holy Grail lineage. It started with John the Baptist. And even though Jesus to them was a great being, a great master, they usually gave their allegiance to John the Baptist and considered him their savior because he actually preceded Jesus. He was the original master and came before Jesus. He was the teacher of Jesus, and this is why they worshipped the Baphomet head and called it their great savior. And it's also said that they denounced their affiliation with Jesus and put their affiliation solely with Baphomet or John the Baptist.
If you could ask John the Baptist one question, if you could go back into time, what might that be, Mark?
I would have to say that tell me your lineage. I have studied the Holy Grail lineage, and I believe I understand it, but I'm not totally sure, so, you know, confirm what I do know.
Okay, stay with us. We'll be back with your questions next. And Mark Pinkham on Coast to Coast AM.